Welcome to the Mead Musings podcast.
Here we open discussions on everyday hidden issues,
like living with disabilities and dealing with illnesses. We also cover issues around conditions such as stroke, diabetes, autism, cancer, leukemia, and also living in abusive relationships.
We focus on helping people see the light at the end of the tunnel.
This podcast is available on YouTube and your favorite podcast platform. Please subscribe.
Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Mead Musings podcast, the podcast where we raise awareness about disabilities and issues that affect mental health. And on today's episode, I'm going to be talking about an issue that is fast growing amongst children and is becoming a thing of concern for parents as well as for teachers and people in the community. So today I have a doctor and wife couple who are also parents to a child living with autism. Autism now affects at least one in 68 children. So that's why I decided to do this special episode today. And I am really grateful to Dr. Wes and his wife for joining us today. So the podcast is going to be shared on different platforms. We are on Google, Apple, Spotify, Good Pods. Anywhere you listen to your podcast, it's on YouTube, it's on Tumblr, it's on any other app that people listen to podcasts on. So just share and let's just keep raising awareness and talking about these issues. So thank you, Dr. Wes and Mrs. Wes, for joining us. They are joining us all the way from, is it?
Florida, sunny Florida.
Florida, yeah. Thank you. So I'll just leave you to introduce yourself and then we'll go on as we've seen fit.
Okay. My name is Chris Weiss. And as you said, we do have a son with autism. I actually went to Florida State University and I majored in chemistry and nutrition. So I really think that that major helped me on my journey with my son because a lot of children with autism have gut issues. I, you know, had a long journey with him. I think we've done a really good job. We wrote a book together on our journey and the things that we did to help him become a productive member of society. And he just turned 29. He's doing great right now. He's living on his own. He drives a car. He has a job. He has a girlfriend, just first girlfriend. So really excited about how well he's doing.
Oh, Eric Weiss. I'm a physician. I went to Davidson College and Duke University Medical School, trained as a general surgeon and as a plastic and reconstructive surgeon. Marston is our son with autism, and that, you know, changed my life because relatively recently we found out that umbilical cord blood and stem cells have the ability to really impact these children's lives and brains, you know, help heal them. And we did that for our son, and it has led me to slow down my surgical practice and to start to do this at least 2 days a week. And it'll probably turn into a full-time job as I give up my surgery practice probably next year. And I'll be treating autistic kids full-time.
Oh, that's amazing. Wow. And you just said that you only just recently realized that the stem cell umbilical cord could be used in treating autism. And this is not something that is widely publicized. So can we just break it down? Because I know there are some people who don't have any clue when we start talking about medical terms. So what are stem cells? How is that really applicable to the treatment of autism?
Well, I'm glad you asked. It's actually a fascinating story. As you said before, autism is growing, you know, in the United States. It's 1 in 40.
It's all over the world. It's not just in the United States.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I just meant it's lower than some other countries.
It is everywhere right now.
It is.
One knows someone with autism.
It's growing. And so there was a study done on autistic children who had died, and they took their brains. it showed that they had brain inflammation, neuroinflammation. So this was the first study that showed there was actually something in their brains that was different than normal people. At the same time, the people who were studying traumatic brain injuries, which is a big problem throughout the world, noticed that when you get hit in the head, you do lose brain cells, but a lot of times it sets up an inflammatory process, which ends up being worse than the original injury. And that's why you could be hit in the head, and 20 years later, you're 30 times more likely to have dementia than if you weren't hit in the head. And so the traumatic brain injury people were looking for a drug or a product that would be neuroprotective, somehow to turn off this inflammatory process. And there were 30 major trials throughout the world and in the United States. And what they found out was umbilical cord blood and the stem cells in it have the ability to turn off brain inflammation. So that was a major discovery, which just happened. So the people at Duke, the pediatric people, knew that cerebral palsy and autism were brain inflammation problems. And so they just decided to see what would happen if we gave these kids this umbilical cord blood, what happened. And they did that. And almost 90% of the kids with cerebral palsy got better, but 60% of the kids with autism got better. And not by a little bit, but by a tremendous amount. And they actually showed that by MRI, they had new connections in their brains, that their brain waves got stronger and more normal, and that all these other parameters, you know, got better. And so this was a landmark study that just came out in 2019. And so, however, right at the end of 2019, the pandemic started. And so a lot didn't happen for a couple of years. So we're just starting to catch up. But this is, you know, is exciting. And many people, you know, don't even know what a stem cell is, but I'll go back. There's kind of two big types of stem cells. There's embryonic stem cells, which there's some ethical and moral issues centered around, because they're taken from fetuses, usually aborted fetuses, or always from aborted fetuses, I should say. And there's something called adult stem cells, which we have circulating in our body. And what most people don't know is about halfway through the second trimester, the stem cells in the fetus switch to adult stem cells, because essentially the fetus is already grown, or it's already formed, I should say. All it has to do is grow. And so adult stem cells are designed to heal. They're designed to protect. The umbilical cord of blood is filled with these stem cells. So all these cells are sourced from live, healthy births, these products that are usually just thrown away.
Yeah, they go to medical waste. You know, this is usually the pregnant mom throws away her cord. You know, she doesn't. In some countries, they are now harvesting them, and you can freeze your cord. But most of the time, it's medical waste.
Right, the placenta, the amniotic membrane, well, everything we call the afterbirth usually gets thrown away. But we're finding out now it has these incredible healing potentials. We kind of knew about it, you know. As an aside, umbilical cord blood is not new to medicine. It's been used in the United States for almost 60 years, mostly for pediatric leukemias, lymphomas, something called inherited metabolic diseases. So there's about 80 different...
So does it mean that they store these umbilical cord cells somewhere and we're not really aware that it's actually useful in treating other illnesses?
Correct. We know it has been useful in some, because we've been using it for almost 60 years, but nobody expected it to be able to treat brain inflammation, and that's brand new.
Oh, thank you so much. And going back to a statement you made earlier, there's an increase in the number of children who are now autistic. What, in your opinion, as a medical practitioner, is the cause of that?
Well, that's a great statement. We know the end result is the brain inflammation. I think there's some leading candidates. We know through studies now that there's something called maternal immune activation, MIA. And if you have a significant viral illness in your first trimester or a significant bacterial illness in your second trimester, one that causes you to be hospitalized, you're much more likely to have an autistic child. And we saw this in a 1964 rubella outbreak in the United States. and then later on in Europe. We also know that inflammatory processes can happen to the child either at birth with ascending infection or potentially after birth with illnesses. Everybody's concerned about vaccines. I'm not, you know, an anti-vaxxer by any stretch of the imagination. But I also talked to a bunch of parents who say everything was fine until that 18 months or 15 months. And we know we're injecting a immunologically active ingredient into these children. So I think all three of these need to be looked at. And then a new one, which is important too, is that women who are overweight or obese when they get pregnant, they tend to have more inflammation in their uteruses. And so there was just a longitudinal study that was just published last year, and it did show that children born to women that were obese had increased neurologic disorders, both ADD as well as autism. So I think there's a variety of potential causes, but whatever it is, it all ends up with inflammation.
Oh, thank you so much. And going back to you, Chris, could you walk me through the process it took for your son to be diagnosed with autism?
It was a long time ago, before the internet, because he's 29. And he's my second child. And I knew he was not developing the same way as my first child. And so I brought him, you know, to the pediatrician. And I'd never heard of autism, you know, but this was 1995. And when he was born, I think the diagnosis then was 1 in 10,000. So it wasn't as prevalent as it is today.
Yeah.
And I was devastated, completely devastated. In my book, tell the story about I'm one of six children. I'm number five of six children. And I have a younger sister who's 5 years younger than me, who is special needs. So I know as a sibling what it was like to be raised in a household with a special needs sister. I saw my life through my mother's eyes, you know, what she had to do to raise neurotypical children and how hard it was on the other siblings. So it was very, very difficult journey.
And when you say you noticed that it wasn't really doing things the normal way, what were the things that you felt were not normal?
Well, he wasn't speaking. He was late to have any kind of visual connections. He kind of was in his own world. When I would talk to him, I would have to lift his face up and ask him to look in my eyes. And that's how I would talk to him. He was just disconnected. He didn't progress in a lot of things. He just walked late. His physical movements were not as good as his brother. Interaction
with other children.
He was, when he would go to preschool, he was by himself. He never was social at all with any of the other children. And when he didn't speak, he didn't speak until he was 6 years old. I mean, he had a couple words and he would point to things that he wanted, but I knew he understood because I would tell him, go up and get your purple pajamas. And he would run upstairs and get his purple pajamas. And then I would ask him, what color are your pajamas? And he would just stare at me. So he had, it was in there. It just wasn't coming out.
That must have been so difficult as a family having to go through all of that. And I know a lot of parents who have autistic children who tend to deny, they don't accept the fact that their child is autistic or is neurodivergent. So that's another issue that we have to face in the society because of the stigmas that are associated with being autistic or raising autistic children. So as a family, how did that impact on you?
Well, I think how it impacted on us, I think that, like I said, my oldest child probably got the hardest impact on him and probably on Eric too.
I think it affects every aspect of the family,
right?
Because you have to take time away from one child to focus on another child. It's a triage situation, and then they get shorted, you know, while you're spending all the time with the autistic child.
Right. And I think even today, you know, my oldest son is 35, and I don't have the same relationship that I probably would have had I not had a special needs child, because I spent so much time with my second child with, you know, therapies. And my oldest son is like his dad. He's very smart. He was easy. He caught on very quickly. So I kind of said, you know, you're fine. I'm going to just concentrate on this one, which didn't have a choice. I didn't have a choice. And as a mother, it hurts even now that I didn't get to see, you know, baseball games that I couldn't go to. There were activities that I didn't get to go to. Do I wish I could have changed it? Absolutely. But I always think now that my son is older, he's a productive member of society. I worked so hard with him to get him to where he is now, that my older son, the neurotypical one, probably doesn't have to work as hard with him, because, you know, he is going to be the person that watches over him. And I know all mothers, every mother thinks this: what's going to happen when the parents die? What's going to happen to that autistic child? They're going to be a burden on. And that's how it is with my sister. All of my sisters and I take care of my younger sister.
Oh, yes. I appreciate that, because I know most parents will give anything at all to take away that tree or even anything that borders their children, you know?
You would trade your life, you know?
I know.
Exactly. So I think it affects every member of the family. It affects relationships. You know, I believe it causes a lot of divorces, because, you know, there is, you know, a stigma. I mean, there were birthday parties we weren't invited to when he was little, because he was, you know, the goofy kid or the weird kid. And so you find out who your friends are, but it's even difficult for them to understand, which is why we're doing this, because, and why Chris wrote the book, because that book is not only good for autistic parents, because it kind of gives them a manual of what we did and how to approach the problem, but it's good for grandparents and friends and siblings, because they don't get totality of the problem.
Right, the magnitude of how difficult it is.
Oh, yes, definitely. Thank
and
you.
And most of my friends, you know, have autistic children, because we're kind of our own little group, you know? It's not a club that anyone wants to belong to.
Yeah.
We know that everyone in this group is real.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I know a lot of parents face similar challenges, and it's not easy to move away from having an autistic child or a child that has special needs. So let's go to Eric now. So what were the areas that you focused your research on when you were, because of your son? Was it?
Well, it wasn't that I did research. I researched it out. The paper from Duke broke, and I read about it. And then I realized, okay, now there is something you can do to actually change the autistic brain at a cellular level. And the kind of three main things of autism are delay in speaking, kind of repetitive aberrant behaviors, and poor socialization. And there are certain areas of the brain that control that. And that's where they found this inflammation. So, I went to Duke, and the paper came out of Duke, and so it was easy for me to call and talk to the people, because the people were there when I was there, and see if they would treat my child. And they would not treat my child, because they said he was too old. They said he was too old. They were pediatricians. He was 22. But I asked them if they think he would benefit.
Sorry. Just to cut you short. So you started treating your child at the age of 22?
Yes.
Oh, wow. So does that mean that this stem cell treatment does not have any age barriers, or does not have any limits to when it would be effective?
Great question.
I believe that is true, because at that original study that broke the knowledge that autistic brains have inflammation, there were two outliers. All were children, except there were two adults, one age 32, one age 44, and they had brain inflammation too. So I just asked the people at Duke, do you think it would work? And they said it probably will, but we're not going to do it because it doesn't fit our protocol. And as you would suspect, I don't know if you know, there's places in Panama and places in Mexico that do it. But I contacted the people in Panama and asked if they would do it. And they said they would not because they don't treat anybody under 18. And then
under 18?
Under 18. And then my son was over 18. But Chris found a great doctor in Chicago, a guy named Thomas Lowe, who he and I were trained very similarly. Had a great conversation with him. And he said, why not? You know, it could potentially work. And it did work. But Tom's a pediatric surgeon. He deals with younger people. And my son kind of stood out as a sore thumb. But he's the one that showed me how to do it. It got me interested and said, you can do this for your son. And so I did. And then it changed his life. It changed my life, changed our life. And my wife said, why wouldn't you do this for everybody? You can't hold back on this therapy. And so
there's families like ours who are looking for this. And I said, you can't not do this for other families. You can do it on Friday. You know, you can stop operating on Friday. And, you know, this is something that, you know, will change people's lives. I know operating changes lives too, but we know what this feels like to look for answers, and we can give that answer to people.
Oh yeah, that's so amazing. Well, I know that, as I said before, there will be parents who want to do this for their children, but they don't have the resources to go ahead with the treatment or with the research or with anything that is required for them to be able to find a solution. So
that is correct. And I would say the two biggest factors are, one, it doesn't work for everybody, but it works for the majority. And the second is the cost. And so there are, you know, many people looking into this in the United States. And eventually, I believe it will be covered by insurance, because there's nothing else out there. And so, but it takes time to go from discovery to mainstream medicine. And in the United States, that number averages about 17 years for FDA approval. Now, I doubt it will take that long, because this product, umbilical cord blood and umbilical cord stem cells, is already approved, you know, by the FDA for other treatments. So it's already, you know, past the safety factor. However, I would encourage all parents just to get on the internet and look for their local medical school or research university and just type in stem cells and autism, because there are many, many studies going on around the world that people are recruiting for. And you could potentially become part of a study and get the therapy for free.
Oh, thank you so much. From what you said now, if one wants to get into the research, how easy is it, or how difficult is it for them to be able to just say, oh, I've got a child that's got autistic spectrum or any other disability? How easy would it be for them to just get onto these research programs?
I think, well, first of all, the answer is it's not easy, because there's so many people, you know, who want to do it.
There's so many people with autism.
Right. So from speaking to the people, you know, at Duke, when they put it out there that they needed, you know, people, they had people from all over the country, you know, in fact, all over the world, trying to get there to get this therapy. So you're based in UK. I would look at the London hospitals and the ones outside to see if they're doing, and either see if your child qualifies, because they may have criteria. You know, they may want so many, you know, males, so many females, this age, right, group. You know, do they want chromosomal abnormalities? Do they not want chromosomal abnormalities? But the time is starting to be where we're gathering a lot of data. So, you know, we can approach kind of the medicine in general and say, okay, this is the way to treat. And then once we figure out how to treat, we'll figure out a way how to prevent.
Right. That's what we want.
Oh, thank you. And talking about this, are there any obstacles that you faced as parents still in this field when you're talking about your child and how, and for your child, even for your son right now, he's 29 and you said he's got his first girlfriend and right now normal. So what are the things that, I mean, areas of improvements that you've seen in him? And then what are the obstacles that you still see him going through?
I think that his obstacles are probably, you know, he has some critical thinking that he's not very good at. He has problems with time management. Like when I tell him, you know, once he gets in a routine, he's fine, but he has a hard time managing certain things in his day, saying, I have to be at, you know, the dentist at 2. Then he has to realize that it takes him a half an hour to get there. You know, so he has a very hard time with time management. He has problems with money is one of the big things. He's not good with calculating change. You know, there's just certain things that are very difficult for him to figure out. And I don't know how to get there. You know, we're having a hard time getting there. But I think he eventually will. You know, he lives on his own and he wants to learn. He's not that kid that doesn't want to learn. He does want to learn because he actually is a pleaser. He's a kid that wants to please you. He's a very happy child. They love him at his work. So there are people who, if he doesn't know how to do something, he'll ask certain people. And there are good people in the world who will take in kids who have certain disabilities and work with them, because he will be there half an hour before he's supposed to be there. And he will stay till a half an hour after, till everyone leaves. I mean, he is a hard, hard worker.
In the last 10 years, obviously a lot of obstacles have broken down just because these kids are becoming more aware. People are becoming more aware of it. The Disabilities Acts and laws that have come through. And so the people at his job love him because he shows up every day and he works hard, but you know, they know to kind of watch out for him and make sure he's moving along during the day. Before the stem cells, he had maybe 20 words and could put 2 to 3 words together. And afterwards, he became fully conversant. You know, you have to watch what you pray for, because you pray for your child to talk. And then he calls me 5 times a day on the phone. And so he's learned how to communicate, and he's learned how, you know, socialization and how social life works, which allows him to
interact with people. Right. It opens up his world. You know, knows how to socialize, knows how to talk to people. Yeah.
Thank you so much. We've got like 5 minutes left. So I've got like questions from some people that sent me questions in. One is like, his child listens, but what do we do to make him talk? He doesn't speak. He knows, like you said, your son could hear.
Understand.
Yeah. And then is hyperactive? How do we slow him down to be able to sit and learn?
Well, these are all very difficult questions.
Yes.
Because now it's been shown that kids with autism have less brain connections in the area of speech. So it would be like asking somebody with a broken arm to lift something. How would you expect somebody to speak if their brain is not formed completely in the area of speech? Okay. So I believe that the key is to keep speaking to them, try to make them speak, because the more you exercise the brain, the more connections are made. However, there will be a point where you have to say, this child needs to communicate with me. And there are very interesting stuff. There's something called facilitative communication, where there's programs where kids use iPads and it talks, and so they can communicate with their parents through technology. There's sign language. There's other ways to communicate by voice, even though that's the way we all prefer. But sooner or later, it becomes counterproductive for the child not to have some way to communicate. Okay. But I think that's why this therapy is so good, because it actually affects the brain, and it affects the brain in the area of speech.
Right. Tell me about.
I also have another question here. Is there any determining factor that is used as a guide for the optimal timing to administer stem cell treatment?
This is all very new science. So we obviously know that, you know, my son got it, you know, in his early 20s and did tremendously well. You obviously want to treat the problem as soon as you can. But there's never been a study done on multiple treatments and treatment timing and even in dosing. In the United States, phase one study is it safe? And phase one studies have been completed for years, and it is safe. A phase two study is, does it work, which is what we're doing now. A phase three study is dosage and administration. And phase four, is this better than anything else on the market? So all these things are coming along, but certainly I think it's better to treat somebody younger than older. But I've given the treatment to children in their late teens and have, you know, profound effects, at kids as young as three and have had good effects. So it
I've had people coming from England.
Yeah, we have people from the UK. I've had people from Africa.
To come back to that, if anybody was going to come to you, how can they reach you, and what are the cost implications for them?
Everything is on the website. There's NorthFloridaStemCells.com, NorthFloridaStemCells.com, or EricWeissMD.com. That's my plastic surgery site, but that'll direct you to the regenerative site. I've done videos. I've answered a bunch of questions. We kind of walk through what the treatment entails. It's actually not too onerous. It's just a simple IV, which with autistic kids is sometimes not so simple. But if we need to sedate the child, we can. It takes only about an hour. It's very safe. But the website, NorthFloridaStemCells.com, will go over it. I probably treated 200 children, and it's safe and works in probably 60 to 70% of.
So thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming on our podcast. It's been amazing listening to your view and your opinions, as well as your experiences with this issue. I know autism is one of those things that is just growing, and we just want to have a way of controlling it if we can. But if not, what can we do to improve chances of, to make it better for people?
Exactly.
Thank you so much, and have a lovely, lovely, lovely Easter weekend.
Yeah, you too. Happy Easter.
Happy Easter.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye now.
A big thank you to all our listeners who have been sending us messages through the message link. I would like to thank everyone who has listened in so far and contributed to this podcast. Thank you so much. We couldn't have done anything without you. Keep listening, keep sharing, keep downloading, and keep liking. Thank you again.